Chapter 23. "Welcome back, Chairman," Max Hanley said when Juan reached the top of the Oregon's boarding ladder. The two shook hands. "Good to be back," Cabrillo said, fighting to keep his eyes open. "The past 12 hours have been about the worst of my life." He turned to wave down at Justus Ulenga, the Namibian captain of the Penguin, the boat Sloane McIntyre and Tony Reardon had been aboard when they had been chased. Juan had contracted the fisherman at Terrace Bay, where he'd been lying low following the attack on his boat. The affable captain tipped his baseball cap back at Cabrillo, grinning broadly because of the thick sheaf of money he'd been paid for the simple job of ferrying Juan's party to where the freighter loitered just outside Namibia's 12-mile limit. As soon as his boat had motored a good distance from the Oregon, the massive freighter began accelerating northward, ersatz smoke pouring from her single funnel. Jeffrey Merrick had been hoisted onto the deck in a medical basket. Julia Huxley was already hunched over him, her lab coat dragging in a hardened pool of oil. Under it, she wore blood-smeared scrubs. She'd been patching together wounded men since the first moment the container Max had used to transfer the soldiers to the ship had been opened. With her were two orderlies standing by to bring Merrick down to surgery, but she wanted to do an assessment as quickly as possible. A blindfolded Susan Dunleavy had been escorted to the ship's brig by Mike, Ski, and Eddie as soon as she'd set foot on the Oregon. It was plain to see that the fact that no one had said a word to her since Juan had nabbed her in the desert was wearing on her mind. Though not yet defeated, her facade was cracking. "What do you think, Doc?" Juan asked when Julia pulled her stethoscope from Merrick's bare chest. "Lungs are clear, but his heartbeat's weak." She glanced at the saline drip bag one of her people was holding above Merrick's prone form. "That's the third unit of saline he's taken. I want to get some blood on him to get his pressure up before I go after the bullet that's still in the wound. I don't like that he's unconscious. Could it be the heroin they gave him back at the Devil's Oasis? It should be out of his system by now. It's something else. He's also spiking a fever, and the wound looks infected. I need to get him on antibiotics." "What about the others? Moses and Debele?" Her eyes clouded over. "I lost two of them. I've got one more that's touch and go. The others were mainly flesh wounds. So long as no one shows an infection, they should be fine. Moses is a bloody mess. The human foot has 26 bones. I counted 58 separate pieces of bone on his x-ray before I gave up. If he's going to keep it, we need to get him to an orthopedic specialist within a couple of days." Cabrillo nodded, but said nothing. "How are you doing?" Hux asked him. "I feel worse than I look," Juan said with a tired smile. "Then you must feel like crap because you look like hell." "Is that your official medical diagnosis?" Julia pressed her palm to his forehead like a mother checking a child for a fever. "Yep." She motioned for her people to lift Merrick's stretcher and started for the nearest hatch. "I'll be below if you need me." Cabrillo suddenly called out to her, having remembered something he couldn't believe he'd forgotten. "Julia, how's Sloane doing?" "She's great. I kicked her out of medical and then out of the guest cabin because I needed it as a recovery room. I even put her to work as a candy striper. She's bunking with Linda. She wanted to be up here to meet you, but I ordered her to bed. We've had a busy few hours, and she's still weak." "Thanks," Juan said with relief as Julia and her team vanished into the ship. Max sidled up next to him, his pipe emitting a fragrant blend of apple and cedar. "That was a hell of a premonition, getting me to contact Langston and tapping into Echelon." One of Juan's first acts when he learned that Jeffrey Merrick's rescue had fallen apart was to get Max to lean on Overholt in order to utilize the NSA's Echelon program. At any given second, there were hundreds of millions of electronic data transfers taking place over the globe. Cell phones, regular phones, faxes, sat phones, radios, emails, and web postings. There were acres of linked computers at the NSA's Fort Meade headquarters that trawled the bandwidths looking for specific phrases or words that might be of interest to American intelligence. Though not designed to be a real-time eavesdropping tool, with the right parameters programmed into the system, like a call originating at the Devil's Oasis geographic location and containing such terms as Merrick, Singer, Hostage, Rescue, Dunleavy, Echelon could find that needle in the cyber haystack. A transcript of Nina Visser's conversation to Daniel Singer was emailed to Max aboard the Oregon 3 minutes after the call had ended. "I had a feeling that after our boys were caught, whoever Singer had left in charge at the prison would want to let him know what was going on and get some new marching orders." Juan ground the heels of his hands into his eyes to try to relieve some of the fatigue. "They're a bunch of amateurs. They wouldn't have contingency plans in place." "What did you do with the rest of the kidnappers?" Max asked. His pipe had gone out and there was too much of a breeze to relight it. Juan started walking toward a hatchway, his mind already in his glass-enclosed shower with the heat cranked as high as he could stand it. Max kept pace. "Left them out there with enough water to last a week. I'll have Lang contact Interpol. They can coordinate with Namibian authorities to pick them up and return them to Switzerland to face kidnap charges, with a charge of attempted murder for Susan Dunleavy. Why bring her back here? Why not let her rot with the rest of them?" Cabrillo stopped walking and turned to his old friend. "Because the NSA couldn't pinpoint Singer's location, and I know she has it, and because this isn't over yet. Not by a long shot. Kidnapping Merrick was only the opening gambit to whatever his former partner has planned. She and I are going to have a nice, long talk." A moment later, they reached Juan's cabin and kept talking as Juan stripped out of his filthy uniform and tossed the clothes in a hamper. He threw his boots into the trash, but first poured out a quarter cup of sand that had entered the shoe through the .44 caliber bullet hole. "Good thing I couldn't feel that," he remarked casually. He unhooked his combat leg and set it aside, planning on giving it to the magic shop staff so they could reload the gun and clean the grit out of the mechanicals. "Mark and Eric checked in about an hour ago," Max said. He sat on the edge of the copper jacuzzi tub while Juan climbed through the banks of steam erupting from the shower. "They've covered about 1,000 square miles, but there's still no sign of the guns or Samuel Macambo's Congolese Army of Revolution." "What about the CIA?" Juan called over the sound of water beating against his skin. "Any of their assets in the Congo have a bead on Macambo?" "Nothing. It's like the guy vanishes into thin air whenever he wants to." "One guy can vanish. Not 500 or 600 of his followers. How did Murph set up his search?" "They started from the dock and have been flying wider and wider circles, overlapping the radio tag's range by about 20 miles just to be safe. The river is the border between the Republic of the Congo and the Democratic Republic of the Congo," Juan said. "Are they staying south of it?" "Similarities to their names aside, relations between the two countries are a mess. They couldn't get permission to cross into the RFC, so yeah, they're staying south of the border." "What do you bet Macambo took the weapons north?" "It's possible," Max agreed. "If Congo's northern neighbors are shielding his army, it could explain why he's never been caught." "We've only got a few more hours until the tags run out of their batteries." Juan shut off the water and opened the door. He was clean but scantily refreshed. Max handed him a thick Brazilian cotton towel. Call Mark and have him do whatever he has to in order to get across that border and take a listen. Those guns aren't more than 150 miles from the river. I'm sure of it. I'll call him now, Max said and levered himself from his perch. Juan kept his hair short enough so he didn't need to brush it. He put on deodorant and decided he looked more dangerous with 30 hours of beard, so he left his straight razor on the bathroom counter. The dark circles under his eyes and their red rims gave him a demonic cast. He dressed in black cargo pants and a black t-shirt. He called down to the magic shop for a tech to get his combat leg, and on the way to the ship's hold, he stopped in to grab a sandwich from the galley. Linda Ross was waiting outside the hold. She was holding a BlackBerry that was receiving signals from the shipboard Wi-Fi network. "How's our guest?" Juan asked as he approached. "Take a look yourself." She tilted the small device so he could see the screen. "Oh, and I want to congratulate you on pulling off the rescue." "I had a lot of help." Susan Dunleavy was strapped to a stainless steel embalmer's table in the center of the cavernous hold where Juan had packed his parachute the day before. The only light came from a single high-intensity halogen lamp that formed a focused cone around the table so she could see nothing beyond. The feed to the BlackBerry came from a camera placed just above the lamp. Susan's hair was lank from so long in the desert without enough water for personal hygiene, and the skin on her arms was blotchy from insect bites. Blood had drained from her face, leaving her washed out, and her lower lip quivered. She was covered in sweat. "If she wasn't tied down, she would have bitten her fingernails to the quick," Linda said. "You ready?" Juan asked her. "Just going over some notes. I haven't done an interrogation in a while." "Like Max always says, it's like falling off a bike. Do it once and you never forget." "I hope to God he didn't put a sense of humor down on his job application." Linda thumbed off the BlackBerry. "Let's go." Juan opened the door into the hold. A wall of heat blasted him. They'd set the thermostat for 100 degrees. Like the lighting, the temperature was part of the interrogation technique Linda had settled on to crack Susan Dunleavy. They stepped silently into the room, but remained just beyond the circle of light. He had to give Susan high marks because she didn't call out for nearly a minute. "Who's there?" she asked, a manic edge in her voice. Cabrillo and Ross remained silent. "Who's there?" Susan repeated a bit more stridently. "You can't hold me like this. I have rights." There was a fine line between panic and anger. The trick was to never cross it during an interrogation. Never let your subject turn their fear into rage. Linda timed it perfectly. She could see the fury building in Susan's face, the way the muscles in her neck tensed. She stepped into the light a moment before Dunleavy started to scream. Her eyes went wide when she saw that it was another woman with her in the hold. "Miss Dunleavy, right from the outset, I want you to understand you have no rights. You are aboard an Iranian-flagged ship in international waters. There is no one here to represent you in any way. You have two choices, and two choices only. You can tell me what I want to know, or I will turn you over to a professional interrogator."
"Who are you people?"
"You were hired to rescue Jeffrey Merrick, right?"
"Well,
you've got him, so turn me over to the police or whatever."
"We are taking the whatever route," Linda said. "That includes you telling me where Daniel Singer is at this moment and what his plans are."
"I don't know where he is," Susan said quickly. Too quickly, Linda noticed. She shook her head as though she were disappointed.
"I had hoped you would be more cooperative."
"Mr. Smith, would you please join us?"
Juan came forward. This is Mr. Smith. Up until recently, he was employed by the United States government to extract information from terrorists. You might have heard rumors about how the U.S. moved prisoners to countries with, how shall I say it, more lenient laws concerning torture. He was the man they used to get intelligence through any means necessary. Susan Dunleavy's lips started trembling again as she stared at Juan. He got anything he wanted from some of the most hardened men in the world. Men who fought the Russians in Afghanistan for a decade, and then our forces for years. Men who swore an oath to die rather than submit to an infidel. Juan lightly traced the outside of Susan's arm. It was an intimate gesture, the caress of a lover rather than a torturer, and it made her stiffen and try to shy away, but the ties holding her down prevented her from moving more than a couple inches. The threat of pain was far more effective than inflicting it. Already, Susan's mind was conjuring images that were far worse than Linda or Cabrillo could conceive. They were letting her torture herself. Again, Linda's timing was spot on. Susan was struggling to rein in her imagination, to banish whatever she'd envisioned. She was finding within herself the courage to face whatever would come. It was Linda's job to keep her off guard. What he will do to a woman, I have no idea, Linda said softly. But I know I won't be around to watch it. She leaned down so her face was inches from Susan's, making sure that Juan was still in her field of view. Tell me what I want to know, and nothing will happen to you. I promise. Juan had to fight not to smile, because suddenly Susan Dunleavy looked at Linda with such trust that he knew they'd get everything they wanted and more. Where is Daniel Singer, Susan? Linda whispered. Tell me where he is. Susan's mouth worked as she fought the sense of betrayal she must be feeling toward divulging what she knew. Then she spit a glob of saliva into Linda's face. Screw you, bitch. I'll never tell you. Linda's only reaction was to wipe her cheek. She stayed close to Susan and continued to whisper. You must understand that I don't want to have to do this. I really don't. I know that saving the environment is important to you. Perhaps you're even willing to die for your cause. But you have no idea what's coming. You can't comprehend the pain you are about to endure. Straightening, Linda motioned to Juan. Mr. Smith, I apologize for asking you to leave your tools behind. I thought she would be more cooperative. I'll give you a hand with the drills and the other equipment you need, and then I'll leave you two alone. She looked back at Susan. You realize that after today, you will recoil in horror every time you look in a mirror. There is nothing I won't sacrifice for Dan Singer, Susan said defiantly. Ask yourself this question. What is he willing to sacrifice for you? This isn't about me. This is about protecting the planet. Linda looked around the darkened hold as if searching for something. I don't see anyone else with us, Susan, so this is most definitely about you. Singer is off someplace safe while you are strapped to a table. Think about that for a moment. And then think about how long you will live with the consequences of your choice today. You are facing years in prison. You can serve them in a Namibian jail or a nice cushy cell in Europe with running water and a bunk that isn't infested with fleas. We haven't decided who to turn you over to. If you hurt me, I will make sure you pay, Susan spat.
Linda arched an eyebrow.
Excuse me? Make us pay? She chuckled. You have no idea who we are, so how are you going to make us pay? You don't get it yet. We own you, body and soul. We can do anything we want with total impunity. You no longer have free will. We took that from you the moment we picked you up, and the sooner you understand that, the quicker all this is going to end.
Susan Dunleavy had no reply to that.
How's this? Tell me what Dan Singer has planned, and I will make sure you are turned over to Swiss authorities on accessory to kidnapping charges. I will convince Jeffrey Merrick to forgo an attempted murder rap.
Linda had been hitting her with the stick. Now it was time to show her the carrot.
You don't even need to tell me where he is, all right? Just lay out the bare outline of what he intends to do, and your life is going to be unimaginably easier.
Linda made a hand gesture like an out-of-balance scale and said,
2 or 3 years in a Swiss prison, or decades rotting in a third-world jail. Come on, Susan. Make it easier on yourself. Tell me what he's planning.
As part of her technique, Linda kept hammering home the point about how easy it would be, how Susan had everything to gain and nothing to lose by telling her. Had Juan not wanted the information so quickly, Linda would have chosen a different question, one that really had no consequences, just to get the dialogue open. Still, she was making progress. The defiance that had hardened Susan Dunleavy's features moments before was giving way to uncertainty.
No one will ever know, Linda persisted. Tell me what he wants to do.
I assume it's going to be a demonstration of some kind, something he wants Merrick to witness.
Is that it, Susan?
Just nod your head if I'm right. Susan's head remained immobile, but her eyes dipped slightly.
See, that wasn't so hard, Linda cooed, as if to a child who'd just swallowed her medicine.
What kind of demonstration? We know it has something to do with warming the Benguela current. A look of shock ran across Susan's face, and her mouth gaped.
That's right. We found the wave-powered generators and the undersea heaters. They were shut down some time ago. Part of Singer's plan has already unraveled, but that isn't important right now. All that's important is you tell me the rest.
When Susan didn't say anything, Linda threw up her hands.
This is a waste of my time. I'm trying to do you a favor, and you won't help yourself. Fine. If that's the way you want it, then that's the way it's going to be. Mr. Smith?
With that, Linda strode from the hold with Juan right behind. He closed the hold's door and spun the lock.
Jesus, you can be scary, Juan said.
Linda was checking the camera feed on her BlackBerry and didn't look up when she said, "Apparently not scary enough. I thought she'd crack."
"What's she doing?"
"Trying not to wet herself."
"So now we wait her out?"
"I'll go back in a half hour," Linda said. "That'll give her enough time to think about what's coming."
"And if she still won't talk?"
"Without enough time to properly soften her up, I have no choice but to use drugs, which I hate, by the way. It's too easy to get the subject to tell you what you want to hear rather than the truth."
Linda looked back at the little screen. "On second thought, She held up a hand with her fingers splayed and ticked them off silently. When the last digit curled into her palm, Susan Dunleavy began screaming from the other side of the closed hatch.
Come back. Please. I'll tell you what he's going to try to do.
A shadow crossed Linda's eyes. Rather than satisfied with her work, she appeared sad.
What is it? Juan asked.
Nothing.
Talk to me. What's the matter?
She looked up at him.
I hate doing this. Breaking people, I mean. Lying to them to get what I want. It leaves me, I don't know, dead inside. I climb into someone else's mind to ferret out information, and in the end, I end up knowing everything about them. How they think, what their hopes and dreams are, every secret they thought they'd never tell. In a couple of hours, I will know more about Susan Dunleavy than anyone else in the world. But it's not like having a friend confide in you. It's like I'm stealing that information. I hate doing it, Juan.
I had no idea, he said softly. If I did, I wouldn't have asked you to do this.
That's why I've never told you. You hired me because I have a certain background and skills that no one in the crew possesses. Just because I hate part of my job doesn't mean I don't have to do it.
Juan gave her shoulder a gentle squeeze.
You going to be okay?
Yeah. I'm going to let her scream for a few more minutes and then go back in. I'll find you when I'm done.
Then I'm going to have a glass of wine too many and try to get Susan Dunleavy out of my head. Go get some rest. You look terrible.
Best suggestion I've heard all day.
He turned to go, wondering how much each of them was sacrificing of themselves to the corporation. They were always mindful of the physical dangers they faced when they accepted a mission, but there was a hidden cost, too. To fight from the shadows meant the justifications for their actions had to come from within each person. They weren't soldiers who could merely say they were taking orders. They'd chosen to be here and do the things necessary to guarantee a free society, even if they themselves operated outside of societal boundaries. Juan himself had felt that burden on more than one occasion. And while the corporation regularly flouted international law in order to achieve their perfect record of success, there were gray areas that they had skirted that made him more than a little uncomfortable. As he walked back toward his cabin, he knew there were no alternatives. The enemies he'd faced when he'd been with the CIA played by the rules for the most part. But the rule book went out the window when slamming airplanes into skyscrapers became a legitimate form of attack. Wars were no longer fought between armies in the field. They were being fought in subways and mosques, nightclubs and market squares. It seemed that in today's world, anyone and anything was fair game. He reached his suite of rooms and pulled the curtains over his cabin portholes. Now, with his bed no more than a couple of feet away, the wave of fatigue that hit Cabrillo made him stagger. He undressed and slid between a set of cool sheets. Despite his exhaustion, sleep was a long time coming.